Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you doing? Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, institution, or branch of the armed forces. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I'm delighted to be participating in this first annual event. I have a hunch that in the years ahead you'll look back and go, you remember when there was only 300 people at this thing? How much fun it was when it wasn't 25,000 and everything was all screwed up and all that. So just sit back and take it all in, because this will be like anything that's done the first time. It's just great to be the groundbreakers and the pioneers and the organizers and so on down. And so that's what all of you that put your energy into this thing will have to look back on. And it'll be a cornerstone, if you're new in AA, of your sobriety. You'll look back and you'll have something that you didn't have prior to AA, which is a lot of pleasant memories about the things that you did. I don't know about your alcoholism, but I hated looking back. That was something I dreaded. When people would say, let's reminisce, I would go, let's not reminisce. I don't want to reminisce. And once you get sober and you start putting together months and years with events like this, it's real pleasant, and you no longer are terrified by your own past. And when you're not terrified by that, you're not terrified about the future. And so this will be an important thing in all of our lives, and it's fun. And look at the people that are here and remember them, and new friends that you're making. And it's just, that's what life is all about, and that's what sobriety is, and that's how lucky we are in Alcoholics Anonymous to have this thing. What I plan on doing tonight is tell you a little bit about myself, and then talk a little bit about AA, and just have some fun. And then get the hell out of the way, and we'll have a dance. And so, yay! But somebody has to do this, you know, so. Just like Nancy and I had to go to Hawaii and check it out, and we couldn't get anybody else to volunteer. And I had to laugh. I went over to Intergroup. We were over there, just got back Wednesday. I was over there about 5 days. So I went down to AA Intergroup, and I said, what's going on over here? What are the problems that you're dealing with? And he said, smoking. Well, I heard the buses thing here tonight. And so there was three or four of them sitting around there, and they were so damn mad at something that had happened to one of the groups that they were going to start a smoking-only meeting. If you were a non-smoker and you went there, you had to smoke. So it was nice to see that Hawaii has the same kind of crap going on that that we have. And if you're in the middle of one of these snits in AA, just come on now. You got to laugh at it, and it's all part of the deal, and we're just human beings. But don't take it that seriously, and we can get over these things. But it is fun to see all the things that come along that we can get bent out of shape over that are really not that important. So anyway, the other thing was flying up here today with years ago I flew a lot in the military, and now I have the most beautiful pilot in the world who flew us up in a 172. Yeah. And it was great. It was just great coming up and just navigating along and flying in here. It was just like a dream. And I'm just delighted and grateful to have Nancy in my life, and it's one of the greatest things that's happened in my sobriety. I came into AA on Pearl Harbor Day in 1964, and And I haven't been drunk since that first meeting, and I owe it all to not drinking. That's the bottom line. That's why I haven't been drunk, is due 100% to not drinking. And so I know there's some people here that are fairly new, and I also know in Alcoholics Anonymous we have a lot of slogans on the wall, but we don't have one that says, don't drink. And technically, you could claim no one told you not to drink. You could say, easy does it, a day at a time, there but for the grace of God, and first things first, and all of that. And so I'll be the one to tell you that if you are coming around and working the program, going to meetings, trying to read the literature and the steps, and you keep getting drunk, check your drinking. I really think that may be the one thing that is screwing your program up, is your drinking. It's a terrible lesson. It's a terrible blow. I thought it was such an extreme position when I came into AA. I just couldn't believe that they said no drinking at all. You know what I mean? It was like, you mean never once in a while? And they said, no, none at all. And God, that just seems like too much for me. And I knew they didn't understand that how much it meant to me to drink, or they wouldn't ask me to not drink at all. And so they were saying, but you only do it a day at a time. And I saw through the day at a time thing right there during that first week and just went, hey, there's a guy up there celebrating his fifth anniversary. Day at a time. I know. I can look at the face on this guy. He's planning on never drinking. I can see it right there. Don't tell me day at a time. I can see another guy had 15 years. He's just going, I said, this place is filled with fanatics and they're coming out with this day at a time stuff just to, you know, try and keep me around. But I don't belong here. I need booze. If I don't go out and don't have booze, the world will get me. I can't function without it. I can't think. And, of course, we stay here and we realize that everybody else who came here was thinking that same way, that asking us to not drink was taking away my whole game plan for living. And I didn't start out like anybody else to become an alcoholic. I started out just as a nervous teenager, you know what I mean? You're walking around, you're going, what the hell is going on around here? Does anybody know? And you're always in line somewhere, and you're trying to go to school, and you're doing the wrong thing, and everybody else is cool, and you're screwed up, and you don't know what's going on, and they know how to dance, and you don't, and the girls like him, and they don't like you, and you can't get on the football team, and nobody wants you, and your parents are all screwed up, and they won't talk to you. And I was just finding life incredibly difficult, and I would classify myself as just sort of a skinny, uptight kid, you know, just, you know, what's the matter with him? He's trying to catch his breath, you know. You know, they'd call you up to the front of the class and they'd go, could you please tell us your birthday? Do you have an easier question for me? That's too much for me. I was, you know. All right, what day is it? And, you know, when fear and that anxiety would set in, you shut down the information processing system and you couldn't answer the simplest things. And then as soon as you were out of that spotlight, you could go, I know my name. I know when I was born. I know all that shit. When I get up there, I can't remember anything. And everything goes down. And so that was it. Everywhere I went, it was up Tightsville. I just, you know, and of course I was suffering from basic growing up pains. That's all it is. You're just an immature teenager going through the pains of becoming a grown-up. And, you know, when you think about it, that's what everybody in the world has to get through. And we all have our little stories of where we did this growing up and learning and so on down, except for us alcoholics. In the middle of this process, we found a shortcut. Screw this growing up stuff. You just pour it in. And as soon as that stuff got in there, you already were grown up. You just went, hey there, I'm cool. I know all this stuff now. And there was no holding us back. There was no shyness. We knew how. There was all the promises of booze that we find in our ninth step in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found right in drinking. You intuitively knew how to handle situations that used to baffle you. You just went, wonder how you do that dance. Oh, I know. Just went out. Hey. You know what I mean? How do you do that? How do you do that? You just pour booze in and it turned on the system and it activated it. And so I had discovered a wonderful secret. When I came across booze, it solved physical problems, mental problems, and spiritual problems. I didn't realize that, but like so many of us, I had a relationship with the Catholic Church, and you may have had some church training and so on down, and I had screwed it up in my own head. I used to blame the Catholic Church on my alcoholism, and then when I got talked out of that, I blamed the Marine Corps, and then I blamed women. Then I blamed men. Then I blamed, and I just had to blame somebody because that's how you kept score in life. And so this idea of a punishing God was permanently planted in my head, and alcohol fixed all that. It just set me free from that particular problem. When I drank, I can remember these, you'd be in a club or somewhere. Later on, I got in a Marine Corps, I'd be down some officer's club, and the band's playing, and I'd be getting half smashed. And I remember every so often, especially down in Pensacola, I'd wander out, and this club was located on the bay down there, and I'd look out over the ocean at night and the moon, and I'd just feel like there was God and me and the moon and booze. You know what I'm talking about? It was like, hey, I'm part of the universe, and then, I had that feeling of being, that they talked about. I heard people talking about this in church and in their own lives, but whenever I was sober, none of that happened. And, the funny thing is, as I look back on it, my problem really wasn't alcohol. My problem was sobriety. Every time I was sober, it was awful. Every time I was sober, things were screwed up real bad. I just hated it when I was sober. I just went, uh-oh, sober. And then I look around, I just go, this is awful being sober. It hurts. I don't know what's going on. And the system isn't working. I'm nervous again. I'm sweating. I don't remember things. And I would get booze in, and then I was fine. So to me, it just wasn't the alcohol. It was the other side of it. But I never put this together until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. My drinking took me into the Marine Corps. There was something going on back in the 50s that I don't really remember what it was. I was in Korea, and we had to go in, or it was mandatory. I don't remember ever deciding anything about the military. So a bunch of guys at school were drinking beer one Saturday afternoon, and they said, let's join the Marine Corps. And I went, let me finish my beer. Went running down there, I want to be a Marine, sign here, and cripes. I'll tell you a true story. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this in a meeting. Maybe I have, but I've forgotten about it for years and years and years. It was that summer before I joined down in Paris Island in boot camp. They had killed a couple Marines, the drill sergeants. They had marched them into the swamps and just let them drown, as a training aid for the rest of them. Don't fuck around, we'll let you drown, And they just, so the Marine Corps had put the word out, no more hurting people. You can't beat up people in boot camp. And so no physical laying on of the hands. And this was in all the papers. So all of us college kids had read the papers and we went, hey, the Marine Corps can't touch us. And this is going to be a piece of cake. I remember showing up with golf clubs. And this is a true story. Everybody came in by train from different parts of the country, and they hit Union Station in Washington, D.C., waiting for the one train that day, later in the day, to go to Quantico, where that's where we're going to get our start. And guys are coming in from all over the place with ukuleles and guitars and sports shirts, and it's like a party atmosphere. And it's going more than that. And one guy was like a lawyer, and he's going, "Don't worry, trust me, they're not going to touch us. We got our rights, and we're going to demand our rights down there." Yeah. You know how you get fired up like that. And this guy got on the train, and he was like the spokesman for the group. He just had everybody organized. And he's just going, "When we get down there, none of you guys talk. I'll go out. I'll talk for us. And you're all behind me, right?" We're going, yeah. We're with you. So we got down on that train platform in Quantico, and there was a black drill sergeant, and the guy was like Superman standing out there at E7. And he started yelling at all of us, "Are you guys..." And this guy walked up to him and he says, "We're not taking any of your shit." And this guy just went, "Whoa!" And they carried him off. And the rest of us are standing there. And I call, and we never saw him again, you know. So the word was out, he was dead. You know. And the ending to the story comes about 4 weeks later. I remember I was standing in line. Standing in line. Everywhere you are, you're standing in line. And I'm looking in this Quonset hut, which was like an office building, and there's an E5 in there on the typewriter, the clerk, sergeant clerk, and he's typing away a report. He was the guy that got knocked out. And it turned out he had been a plant, since they couldn't really hit anybody. They just had this guy show up. And it was all a stage punch and the whole thing, but I'll tell you, that worked like a charm. Because anyway, that got me in, and I knew shortly that I had made a big mistake in the Marine Corps. They love to just dig holes in the wintertime and go, "Hey, it's real cold tonight. Let's sleep out." Dig a hole, lie there, and I would lie there all night and just freeze. And that's when I saw a movie about pilots. And these guys were in the O Club, and they were all going like this and having a drink and this, you know, and the carrier and a few things. And I said, "There it is. That's for me, boy." And that's what I signed up for and somehow got into that and flew for the Marine Corps for 12 years and mostly was an alcoholic. But I had a lot of fun, a lot of action, traveling around in fighter squadrons and flying good airplanes and a lot of fun adventures. But that's not my story. My story is being an alcoholic because the illness just was moving on all the time that this alleged career was going. And it slowly came in where drinking was in charge and I was just along for the ride. And there came a time when drinking took away my flying. It just came in and made my hand shake so bad and made my vision so bad and made heart palpitations and sweats. And the ending came when I was flying F-8s out of Cherry Point, and I would have these withdrawal attacks. I learned some of these other pilots. Now, they were drinking while flying, and I didn't. And that was my mistake. And I was suffering withdrawal from alcohol while flying, and that was just terrifying me because all these crazy things were happening. If I'd just been drinking, I could have made it maybe another couple years. But the last time I remember flying was I was flying around with one hand on the ejection seat because I thought I was gonna pass out. I don't know any other pilot who was dealing with this problem. We're on a photo mission, trying to fly a photo mission and deal with passing out. You know what I mean? Alcoholics always have one more thing that they're dealing with than the rest of the people. You know what I mean? You're sitting in a sales meeting and the rest of the people are worried about being called on and making a good presentation. You're worried about being called on and making a good presentation and wetting your pants or puking. You know what I mean? Or you're worried that in the middle of the presentation, a sheriff is going to come in and arrest you, you know, and have the bench warrant out, and you've been getting phone calls. Oh, yes, I think you ought to buy... Oh, well, sorry. So we always have one more thing that is on our mind, and on my mind was passing out. I just felt like I was going to go, so I had to deal with that. I had to solve the dilemma of passing out, and that's where we come up with alcoholic thinking. I remember I learned how to alcoholically think in college when I got yanked off a bar stool up in New Haven. Some guys came in and grabbed me by the back of the hair and, Jesus, beat the hell out of me. And I wanted to keep drinking in that same neighborhood. It was my kind of place. So I got a crew cut. And I went, hey, nobody will pull my hair off the bar. You know what I mean? We couldn't think any other way than that, you know? A regular person would say, I'm not going to drink there and get drunk and all that. But I wasn't willing to give up any of those things. That wasn't an option. So my answer to this problem of passing out in an airplane was, hey, if I pass out and my hand is on the ejection seat, as I pass out, I will be ejected and the chute opens automatically and I'll just float down. Hey, problem solved. You know what I mean? That's very bizarre if you were to write that down and share that with the Navy or the Marine Corps. Hey, a little procedure here I'd like to share with you. Get it written into the pilot's manual. Hey, feel like passing out? One hand, two. $1 million airplane. So those kind of thoughts and solutions we didn't share. And all of us have these crazy things that we ended up deciding to do that we didn't share with anybody. And we thought we were the only ones until we got in AA. And then you look around, everybody in the place has a story like that. And you finally feel like you're home and you're finally able to share some of these stupid, crazy things that you ended up thinking up and were, under the conditions, a viable solution. I mean, you know, for an alcoholic, that was a pretty good solution. And just, yeah, man, that's safe. But it ended up where I then went and saw flight surgeons, and they agreed we had a serious problem. So that was the end of my flying. They took me out of flying status. High blood pressures, trembling hands, vision all screwed up, and just heart palpitations, all of these things. And their answer to this was to make me an air traffic controller. That's what I did for the last 2 years of my drinking was I brought planes in bad weather when they couldn't see the runway. So a lot of people had a problem with my drinking. And I don't have any bad stories about, people crash or anything like that, thank God. But at the end of this, there came a time when I ended up in a career school in Quantico, Virginia, moving up to become a general or something like that, and had this little thing happen. I had a grand mal seizure while answering a question in a classroom. Almost bit my tongue off. And that caused a few, what's going on there? You know, that kind of a problem you can't ignore. And so they went, medic, medic, medic. And they came in, and next thing I'm in the nut ward of the Bethesda Naval Hospital, where before the Navy had any alcohol program, and I was locked up there for 6 months. And sitting there with psychiatrists and all the rest of the schizophrenics and manic depressives and all these things. And we would sit around in chairs and group therapy and talk about various things and go to clay class and basketball and back into the thing. And what'd your mother do and what is this and blah, blah, blah. And about once a month, they would talk about alcoholism. Because they had to, because they had four alcoholics in the nut ward. And they would gather all the nuts in a circle, and the psychiatrist would say, today we're going to talk about alcoholics. And then all the other people in there would go, oh, you know, like, in the nut ward, the alcoholic was low man. And then they were like, hey! I'm a schizophrenic, you drunk. There's a drunk over here. I'm looking down at you. You're always near the bottom as the alcoholic. And so they would go around in these little chairs and they would go, what do you think about the alcoholics? And this is what, you're not going to believe what they said. This is why they were locked up in there. They said to a person, you guys ought to stop drinking. Look at them. What? And we would get together afterwards and go, no wonder they're locked up in here. Crazy. Those people are crazy. Stop drinking. Give me a break. And the next time I heard that crazy idea was from you. Right in here. And it seemed equally as crazy. But there was an AA group from Bethesda. Guy named Red F. He's still around, a little redheaded guy, and they talked to the Navy captain psychiatrist, and they said, we got to get an AA meeting started in the Bethesda Naval Hospital, and I got the Alcoholics Anonymous because a corpsman came into the nut ward and said, all drunks fall in. Left face, forward march. My little blue bathrobe on, and I'm going down. I can sing. And here's three or four outsiders are coming in. They're looking at us and they're knowing who we are. And I'm going, hey, what about anonymity? And so they told us, they gave us a meeting and they told us all about it. And I had to admit, it was pretty exciting. And I thought, listen to this guy. And I went up and told him, you know, in all honesty, I was a little hostile when you guys first arrived here, but you really, that made it sound interesting. And I'd like to get your card or something, because when I get out of here, if I run into a guy with a drinking problem, I would love to send him your way, you know. And I was just so detached from relating to me joining Alcoholics Anonymous. And the guy just gave me the Buck Doyle poking in the chest, you know, just, hey, wait a minute, buddy, let me ask you a question. And this is my first contact with the AA reality. Here's a guy I just met, and he's going, let me ask you a question. Yes, sir, go ahead. Which one of us is going to put his overcoat on and go on out and get in his car and drive on home to his family? And which one of us is going to put his little blue bathrobe back on and go over in that elevator and get locked up for the night? Now, which one? And I remember going, Jesus, this guy is rude. You know what I mean? We just met. I'm trying to be a friend. I went up and resented him. Took that resentment and, for about a month. And then my turn came up to be an outpatient, where I was allowed out to go home on weekends and at night. And while they figured out what they're going to do with me. And so the first thing I did was get drunk at him, because of what he had done to me, being so rude and so on down. And out of that last drunk came a desperation move of, Jesus, you know, they told me if they ever caught me drunk again, I was going to get thrown out of the Marine Corps. And so I dialed Alcoholics Anonymous on this Pearl Harbor day over this weekend in 1964, and a great big guy came to my house, another Marine that Intergroup sent, and he came to the door and said, my name is Bill. This is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen. And I was, ugh. And I said, well, if you could leave some literature. And he said, get in the car. And I said, well, whatever. And he says, get in the car. And finally, I got in the car. And that's been over 22 years ago, and I've never had another drink. This guy just took me off to AA, and that was it. I never intended for all of this to turn out this way. 2 years later, I got thrown out of the Marine Corps. Went to a meeting every night and got thrown out of the Marine Corps. And I'll tell you, I thought that was unfair. Let me tell you, everybody been sober a while and had something unfair happen. You go, hey, wait a minute. I joined AA. That unfair shit is supposed to stop now. Hasn't someone told them that I've turned over a new leaf? This stuff isn't supposed to keep happening now that I'm sober. You know, and that was my reaction. I just couldn't believe it. I just said, how could this happen? And then, you know, now I look back on it, I should have been thrown out the first year. I mean, my God, with my track record, I forgot to mention my favorite hobby was getting drunk at Officers Club. And I love microphones when I had a few drinks. And I would get up on the dance floor and tell jokes about generals. Boy, people love that, and they'd egg me on, and then these guys are, who is that guy? And they'd write his name down. So when my turn for promotion came up to major, they just, oh, I remember that guy. And so two times around, and you're out. And so I was out, and I resented it, and I didn't have a job, and I didn't get any retirement. All I got to keep was my sword. And I had six kids, and I'm moping around with 2 years sobriety and the resentment. And I'm not telling anybody how resentful I am, but people are constantly asking you, what's wrong? Everybody had that when you're sober. What's the matter? And you answer back, nothing. You know, get away from me, goddammit. But boy, I felt this was just a fundamental wrong that could never be forgiven. I mean, this was not one of those casual things that happens to other people. This one was, you know, just against the universe. I felt it was such an injustice. Now I look back on it and I laugh, but it was serious, serious business at that time. And I'll tell you the ending to that. I had been out about 3 months and the resentment was getting bigger. I would get in a room alone to nurse it and get the thing going. You want to deal with a resentment, go and lock yourself in a room and really work on it. It's like putting bread in the oven, you know. Pretty soon you need a bigger room, you know, and going again, hey, me and my resentment. And you just walk around, and, you know, and eventually you get drunk. And for some unknown reason, I was reading the Washington Post, and back somewhere in the page 20, a very small little article about a Marine Corps instruction team that I was the operations officer of out of Quantico had just flown into a mountain in Denver, and everyone was killed. And if I had had my way and been promoted, I would have been dead. And I remember reading that, and I had been complaining very hard to God. I had decided to blame all this on God. I said, God, for Christ's sake, you know, I'm in this program, I'm praying, I'm doing everything right, and you crap all over me, and I'm reading this thing. And I knew that God knew I just read that. And I remember just going squirming, you know, like, hey, if you just told me this was going to happen, I would. I'd like to take back all after the first complaint that I had. And so all of a sudden, life got fair again. And so I've maybe learned a lesson out of that. And I would say to any of you that are suffering the injustice of the universe right now, wait a while. It hasn't ended yet. It hasn't ended yet. There may be one more fact that's going to fall into place, and you're suddenly going to go, oh, well, with that. Now you put it that way, Christ, that ain't such a bad deal after all. So just forget it and sit back and see how the thing turns out. Go to a meeting, stay sober, and have some fun. Go on a ski trip and let the damn thing work itself out. But don't die from those resentments and injustices. Stop keeping score on the injustice of the world that screws up sobriety. They happen. Somebody put it the best I've ever heard. I don't know, I was at a PI meeting, and one of the patients over there who'd gotten out, they couldn't have had more than 3 months. And somebody's asking about these kinds of things. And their answer was, hey, shit happens. You know, hey, shit happens. And that's it. You don't have to go beyond that. Well, what's that? Oh, shit happened. Oh, okay. Gripes. We make a federal case out of it. Whoa! You know, like, hey, and just, oh, some of that happened. Okay, boom, you move on, and that's it. And then it's nothing. It's when we take that event and turn it into this monumental thing that our lives are just put in jeopardy, our sobriety. Mine is, anyway. That kind of stuff is real bad, real dangerous. But it's human nature. So we come in here, Let me take about the last few minutes here. Talk about AA. Because I got thinking about us being up here. And this is the first one of these ski weekends, and we're starting something that'll probably be going on for lots of years. And people will look back and say to the committee and the pioneers that got this thing started that, God, I'm glad they did that. You know what I mean? If they didn't do that, all of this stuff wouldn't be carrying on every year. And I feel the same way about the co-founder, the AA itself. What an incredible miracle it was. And I know there's some new people here, and maybe you're not familiar, but we're right near the birthplace of both of the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're from Vermont, which isn't very far away from here. We could be over at Bob Smith and Bill Wilson's birthplaces in Nothing Flat. So they came from this part of the country, kind of a rugged area that has hardly got a reputation for being the party capital of the United States. The most unlikely origin for the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous to ever come from. And so they would never be in a Hollywood script that this wonderful organization was founded by a proctologist and a stockbroker who came from Vermont with a rather strict upbringing, and back in the early 1900s, one of them went off to war in the army, and the other one knew from the very beginning that he wanted to be a doctor. The other one, Bill, never knew what the hell he wanted to be, but they both ended up with this absolutely debilitating illness of alcoholism. And those of you that are familiar with Bill's story, who has done most of our writing in Alcoholics Anonymous, know that he was your shaker and mover. He was the guy who just, you know, had to go for the big time. And when he found out about Wall Street, he wanted to go down there, he wanted to get rich, he wanted to be big, he wanted to have all his country clubs and all that stuff, and he learned, you know, how to move in these circles and drank and was partying and all this kind of stuff, but he was an alcoholic. And as it progressed, he ended up in sanatoriums. They had no AA, they had no knowledge of alcoholism. And so they just stick them in these treatment places that fill them up with whatever drugs they thought might work and tell them not to drink and try to get them going. And there'd be one shattering failure after another as he'd come out and get a month back on it and then back in. And there came a time, one time, when he got a phone call from an old drinking buddy. And we hadn't seen him in a long time. As a matter of fact, the last time he had seen him, they had taken a plane and were the initial flight into the Manchester, New Hampshire airport. I was up there last year, and I was standing around looking at it because I had read about the Manchester, New Hampshire airport, which is in the AA history. And I was looking at all the people standing in the lobby, and I said, I bet they don't know what I know about this airport. And what I knew about the airport was I knew the first flight that ever landed at the Manchester, New Hampshire airport, because on that flight was Evie and Bill Wilson and a pilot. And the pilot was a drinking buddy of theirs. And he called them up and said, the mayor of Manchester has asked me to make the first landing at the opening of their new airport. And would you guys like to come? There's going to be a big party after. Oh, yeah. So they're on the plane. And they get up there, and they got the band, and the whole town is out, and they're marching around. And the plane arrives, and they're not ready for them. So they circle the airport drinking. And they're having a ceremony down there, and they're just circling and drinking. And the damn ceremony goes on for about 35 minutes, 40 minutes. And they just get wasted in the plane. And the plane lands at the Manchester thing, and they open the door, and the three of them fell out on the ground and never got up. And that was the opening ceremony of that airport. But at any rate, the thing that sort of preceded all of us being here, that just everything has a beginning, and it's so, to me, it's just so interesting that AA's beginning was so bizarre and so off the wall. I mean, think about the cast of characters. You got this stockbroker sitting in New York, recently out of a sanatorium. His wife is now working. He's stealing money out of her pocketbook to keep a bottle of vodka or gin on hand so that he can think up another big deal in his head. He knows if he just drinks some more, he'll get this big deal, and then he will make a lot of money, and so he's really stealing her money for her good. You know what I mean? Remember how we rationalized that? And he gets the phone call from his old buddy who's going to come over, Ebby. And Ebby arrives on a Saturday morning, and Bill looks at him and gets real nervous because he's healthy. And he looks well, and his eyes are clear. And he says to himself, this is trouble. And Ebby says, Bill, I'd like to share something with you. I've got religion. And there was this sinking feeling as Bill looked at this guy and sat there drinking gin and hearing this story about religion. And he just couldn't buy any of this until Ebby said something that gave us the opening that I think has freed us from the debate that goes on in our heads. It's one of the great things about AA. And he said, Bill, you don't have to take my idea of a higher power. Why don't you just have one of your own, whatever you say it is? And that, you know, that idea coming just sort of on the spur of the moment in a kitchen with a bottle of gin sitting on the tables. And one guy saying, you don't have to take any particular idea. You don't take my idea of God. Just take one, whatever you say it is. That has opened up us to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of the key things that allows this program to open up to all of us. Because no matter where we're coming from, it's pretty hard to argue with that concept of a higher power. It's whatever you say it is. It's awful hard to say, no, sorry, that's not acceptable to me. I won't be able to buy that as a concept. So it shuts down a debate over one of the most important things that I think we all have to deal with, which is a realization that if we're powerless over alcohol, and I had this debate went on for 6 years in AA, I couldn't come to grips with the idea of a higher power. It just was bugging the hell out of me. And maybe there's somebody new here that's wrestling with that same thing. But we start out with step one, and when it says you're powerless over alcohol, you got a real problem if you admit to that. Because if you've admitted you're powerless over alcohol, the only answer to being powerless is a power. And it has to come from somewhere. And so AA doesn't have any God. There is no AA God. I think the only thing that AA does is teach us the absolute need for one. It just simply says, you got a problem, and if there isn't a higher power, you're in deep shit. And then AA says, change your mind. You go, change my mind? Change my mind. Give me a break. I'll go to meetings. I won't drink. I'll get a sponsor, but change my mind. Jesus, I mean, how far do I have to go in this program? For a lot of us alcoholics, change my mind. What is this? Brainwashing? This is a communist organization? Jesus Christ. You're asking too much of me. For many alcoholics are going to change their mind, they hold a press conference. Hello, everybody. I'd like to announce I am about to change my mind. I've held this position for many, many years. Very important. It's a conviction I've had. It's been in our family forever. Feel like a traitor, but I am going to change my mind. What are you going to change your mind? I'm going to trust people, you know, or something like that. Oh, I see. Yeah. It was a conviction of mine for years that you should never trust anyone, or whatever it might have been. And the freedom of sobriety, I really believe, is in changing our mind about all these ideas that I had formed, and we all seem to have accumulated before we get here, that aren't true. That's the problem. We've collected them. I don't know about you, but I got a lot of my basic ideas about life were written by brilliant philosophers in bathrooms. And you're in there. You know what I mean? You're sort of sitting there, and you look over and you go, Jesus, I didn't know that. That's amazing. God damn, what if that really is true? What if it's true and I didn't know it all these years? And I go out and ask my friend, is that really true? And he said, you didn't know that? Ha, 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 ha. So I won't ask anybody about that. I'll just tuck it away up here. And so we have a collection of stuff that has been assembled up there that is our basic idea and game plan for living. And sobriety in AA and the freedom we find here is to start dumping that stuff. And that's what inventories and all of our wonderful steps are about. They were given to us almost by accident from this early origin, which just occurred as spontaneously as anything. The last story I'd just like to mention about AA starting, because most people give this as the moment in time when AA started, was in Akron, Ohio. Bill had been locked up a few more times, and in a sanatorium one night had said, if there is a God, please help me. And he experienced one of these incredible experiences that happens, I don't know, one in 50,000 or something, where all in a moment you get a sense of sobriety and your life has changed and your personality has changed. And for most of us, it occurs rather gradually in our sobriety in AA. At the end of a year, you look back and you go, God, I'm really a different person than I was a year ago. That's sort of a personality change, a spiritual change, whatever you want to call it. With Bill, it all happened in this one split second. Now, whenever anything happens to you, you think that's the norm. And so he's out trying to tell other drunks about sobriety. And he's walking into bars because he knows he wants to share this thing. You know what I mean? He says, I've got this wonderful thing. I'll go out and give it to all the other drunks in the world. This is the early pioneering work of AA. And he's going into guys that are drinking rum in a bar. And he's going, you don't have to drink that stuff anymore. Just listen to what happened to me. I'm sitting on the bed. I said to God, hey, I need some help. And he said, woo, and there were white lights and the wind is blowing. And I had a feeling I was on a mountaintop. And I'm sitting there and they're going, hey, that happens to me when I drink rum. What do I need to do for it? So they went. He was going nowhere with sharing about the spiritual experience. And it was out in Akron when he had about 6 months sobriety, putting the deal together again. He is assembling the big money deal. And he's out there and he just needs a couple more proxies on one of those rubber machinery companies, a lot of rubber manufacturing out in Akron. And if he can get one more signature, he's going to be the vice president of the company. And he's alone in the hotel and the deal falls through. And we got a drunk with 6 months sobriety standing outside a bar, and the deal fell through. And he's really depressed, and he's listening to the music in there and the piano bar and all that. And it occurs to him, and this is when most people say AA started, with this thought. I better go find another drunk to help, or I'm going to get drunk myself. And why that thought popped into this guy's head in Akron, Ohio, in 1935, you can explain. I just think that somewhere in the big card game up there, they said, let's give those drunks a chance. You know what I mean? They ain't never going to figure it out themselves. Let's give them one shot. I'll give them this one little edge, and then they're gone. Because that's the most unnatural thought. Think about it. Imagine yourself. You're in the Akron, you got money, the booze over here, the deal falls through, and you go, hey, there's the church directory over here. I think I'll call the rectors and see if they know a drunk I could go talk to. And that's how he got in touch with Dr. Bob, and they met the next day after Dr. Bob sobered up. And that was the beginning of AA, the two of them sharing. And from that day forward, it has been just an incredible process of passing it on. From a very small beginning of two people, at the end of 4 years, they had 100. And then Bill wrote the big book and put all this out. And now the book is mailed off to different cities around the country. And there's some incredibly wonderful stories. Down in Richmond, they serve beer at AA meetings. They thought that would be a good way to get started. And they don't serve beer there anymore because it didn't work. Very simple plan. And there's lots of other stories about how the meetings get started, but AA, as you go around the country and around the world, is very different. The meetings will be an hour and a half. There'll be half speaker, half discussion. They'll go and start at different times of day, different formats. They read certain things. They have all these different ways, and they reflect the personalities of the guy who got the first big book. He heard about AA, wrote into New York, got a big book, said, okay, get a meeting, call Joe. Joe, we're going to have a meeting, 7 o'clock. I have to go to work at midnight, so the meeting's here will be 7. And, you know, and 25 years later, they go, how come the meetings in Wiggins, Mississippi are at 7? And they go, well, back in the 25 years ago, Charlie had to go to work at midnight. The goddamn meeting had to be at 7. And it's still going on. Charlie's been dead for 15 years, but nobody knows why they're still at 7. You know what I mean? Now the meeting's at 7, you know. And so if you find these wonderful differences around, it's because it just came and unfolded. The story just is a wonderful story. The AA story is exciting because it is an incredible thing of miracles that are so commonplace that we forget they're miracles. We watch a new person come in, a young person whose life is total shambles. They're really going to die if they keep down the path they've been going, and their parents have taken them to 12 different other places. It's hopeless. And they come walking into AA, and the group gathers around, I'm sick with us. Come on, we're going to the ski weekend. We're going over here. We're going over there. And then their life straightens out. We all just go, of course it did. What the hell do you think happens here? You know what I mean? And we forget what just happened. I mean, this is an absolute miracle. This is an incredible reversal. So the power that's here is marvelous. It has to be more exciting than bare sobriety. It's more exciting than drinking was. The trip, I'm saying this for those of you that are new, you're on the beginning of something. And what you're going to do and what you have been through that you are so ashamed of, and you look back on your past and all the things that you've done, and you see them as the scum of the earth. You know what I mean? Oh, I did this and that. All of these things have no value. You feel like they're just trash, that your life and everything, every experience in it is worthless trash. And you come in here, and you know something? Those experiences are the tool that you use to save the next person. That is the most valuable part of your life in this incredible paradox in Alcoholics Anonymous. The reason you can reach out to the next young person out there and take their hand is because of all the shit you've done. It's because of all the crap that you had to go through. It's because of your background they will listen. And they will just go, I'll follow that person. They know where I'm coming from. They came out of the same hellhole I was in. And so this stuff that was absolutely worthless is your most precious possession. This is your little extra gift. And what we learn here in AA is why that's of value and how it all fits together. And it's part of a bigger plan that we didn't even know was going on. We were trying to write our own script for life. We wanted it to turn out a certain way. And I'll tell you, this is my own opinion. You would get shortchanged if you got what you wanted, because you don't know how to ask for the important things. You don't even know what they are. I didn't have any idea what's in store for me, some of the things that have happened that I never knew existed. Coming up on this weekend, you never would have dreamed of going to a sober ski weekend. You never would have asked for that. You never would have asked to go to Smoky Church basements to talk about God. That would have been on your list? I doubt it. And yet, here it is. These things are just handed to us. It's as if, and I really believe this, there's an incredible, wonderful set of things that are in store for you. Just take my word for it. There's a wonderful set of things that are in store for you. They've been just sort of laid out. And the plan for having them happen to you is in our 12 steps. Don't make up a plan of what's supposed to happen to you, because it'll be much less than the one that's intended for you. Don't dream up what your life should be like. Don't try it, because it just will shortchange. We have something that's incredibly better here. This is what a spiritual program is all about. That's what turning our lives over in step 3 and all these things that we talk about is, to make sure that we get something better than we could ever dream up on our own. On our own limited imagination, our own limited view of the universe. We become part of something bigger, and then you get, and look at this. I mean, this is something that a group produced, and it's a phenomenon and an event that you can't enjoy on your own. You can't pull off this thing on your own. You can't sit back there and not be part of AA and go, I'll go out and have fun skiing. And then you arrive here in your car by yourself, and then you go up skiing, you come back, you go, that isn't as much fun as I thought it would be, and you drive back alone. You know what I'm saying? This is the way we used to be. Now, we just are going along with this. If you're new, stay in the middle of AA, and you can't slip off the edge. You can stay in here, and what's supposed to happen will happen. That's all I want to say tonight. I want to thank you all. It's been great for me, and let's let the rest of the evening go on. And for somebody who's in their first month or so, I just hope I'm here next year and that you'll share with us what this thing, what your memories of this weekend are next year. I just want to hear you talk about this weekend a year from now and tell us, because that makes us feel young again. I feel like I'm